You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th. And it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger. Definitely some disgust.
Rose!
And I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
You're listening to episode number 30 of Living the Dream with Rory O'Malley. If you like the podcast, remember to subscribe, rate, and review, or just tell your friends.
Audition, side job, swimming upstream. Believe it or not, you're living the dream.
Hey there, dreamers. Rory O'Malley here. Thanks for listening to Living the Dream with Rory O'Malley. My guest this week is Seth Rudetsky of SiriusXM's Broadway channel, of Broadway, of, God, I can't even come up with a complete list of all the things that Seth Rudetsky is involved in with the Broadway community, but he has an amazing story. He went from being in the pit of a Broadway show playing the piano to the working on the Rosie O'Donnell show to hosting events for Broadway Cares to being one of the main faces of SiriusXM Broadway channel. And, you know, if you are a part of the Broadway community, you know Seth Rudetsky. He is, as he says it, a fan and also a performer and someone who has access to everyone in the industry. He's talked to everyone. So it was a really great conversation. I've always been so curious to know how he forged this path, how he made this career for himself that is unlike anyone else. And I got a lot of insight into that. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with him. We also spoke with his husband, James. Seth and James, a year ago after the tragedy in Orlando, put together a group of Broadway performers, and I was lucky enough to get to participate to sing What the World Needs Now is Love, Sweet Love, and the Burt Bacharach beautiful song. It was to recording it to raise awareness and to raise money for the victims in Orlando. And since then, they've just gone on to do concerts and appearances, and they've always done such great things for very good causes. And they will be performing with a concert this Saturday in San Francisco at the Curran Theater at 7 o'clock. And if you are here in San Francisco, you definitely should check it out. I will be there at the beginning of the show and then run over to Hamilton the same night. It's going to be really, really amazing. Huge performers, Alan Cummings, Faith Prince. So many wonderful people are going to be at this show, and you definitely should check it out. Jane Lynch, it's going to be a great night for a great cause. I am so glad that I was able to find a time that Seth Rudetsky could sit down and speak with me. This is the longest conversation I've ever gotten to have with him because he's doing so many things. He's a hard man to track down. But please enjoy my conversation with James Wesley and Seth Rudetsky. So hi, guys. Hi, Seth. Hi, James.
Hi, Rory.
Thank you so much for being on the podcast. I am so excited for this weekend. You have a big concert coming up in San Francisco.
Yeah, and you have a five-minute appearance.
I do. I'm starting the whole thing off.
That's right.
A pretty big 5 minutes, right?
Yes. Yes, we're going to be at the Curran Theater, which, by the way, I just saw. I was reading research. Is where Peter Pan did its out-of-town tryout with Mary Martin.
Wow.
I had no idea. Just saying. Little side note.
No, there's a lot of history in theater in San Francisco, and the crowds have been so enthusiastic and amazing. And
they know kind of stuff are here, everywhere so. For Hamilton. It's like I've yet to see like a crowd boo.
That's true. That's true. We'll find that crowd somewhere.
Although they apparently did that for Angela Lansbury when she did Sweeney Todd. She said that when she went to San Francisco, they all wanted like baubles and beads of Maine.
Oh.
And she was all frumpy, and they were like, "We don't like this show." That's what she said.
What? Because it was at, was it the out of town before I went to Broadway?
No, it was the national tour, and she's like, I can't wait to San Francisco, and they were all like, where are your gowns?
Even after they already knew the show and what it was?
I guess they still thought,
wow.
They're like, surely she's going to get dressed up, and it turns out she did not.
Oh my
not.
God, they're like, where's B. Arthur? That was ridiculous.
That was Len Cario, same track, same vocal range. Anywho,
so you guys have done an amazing thing. You put together a song a year ago after the tragedy in Orlando, and it's really turned into something much, much bigger. Obviously, if you guys are involved, it becomes a big production with the Broadway community and has raised a lot of money and done some amazing things. Can you just tell me how this all started?
I'll begin one thing. Basically, we were very frustrated. It happened 2 years ago with foster care with the mayor had appointed this horrific woman to Child Services, who was cutting this major foster care program that helped teens get adopted. So James said, we have to put in a big benefit to try to save this organization because most kids don't get adopted past age 8.
And we had hardly any time because our goal initially, it was beginning of May and the fiscal year for New York City is June 30th. And we wanted to get the funding restored. We wanted to get attention and all that stuff. And they really needed the money or they were going to go under.
So we called our big, like, fancy friends that produced like major events, which have remained nameless, but they were like, you'll never get it done in 2 months. And we were like, watch us. So we did this big Broadway event and we got Tina Fey and Jane Krakowski and it became this big, amazing thing. And that's kind of when we first really worked together very closely.
Right. And we knew that we could put something together really big, really fast. It gave us that confidence because, I mean, Seth had obviously done, before I met him, a lot of benefits on Broadway, but they weren't done in 4 weeks.
No, dear. So we kind of knew we did that. And then when Orlando happened, it was the Tony Awards and Jennifer Simard from Disaster was nominated from the show that I wrote and James co-produced. And instead of being really happy that day, it was very depressing because of Orlando. So the next morning.
So the next morning, I went for a bike ride. I normally watch the news kind of obsessively and I am a morning person. And so while Seth was still asleep, my normal routine would have been to watch the news, but I just couldn't bring myself to do it. And so I went for a bike ride and coincidentally, I'd already been listening on Spotify to Dionne Warwick's version of What the World Needs Now is Love. And so I just started biking from the Upper West Side down the Hudson River and just put it on a continuous loop. And as I was riding down, I thought of We Are the World and doing it one solo line at a time. And I could picture us doing it. And I thought, well, Seth and I can get this together, but we'd need to do it soon. It couldn't be like 2 months from now the song comes out. The moment is now. And because sadly people do forget about tragedies, even as big as the one at Pulse. And in fact, look at all the tragedies that have happened in the last year. And so because we had just done the Disaster album, I knew who to get a hold of to get the song rights and if we could get them. And so I'd gotten in touch with her and I did all the stuff. And then I woke up Seth and I said, okay, we need to do this and we need to do it Wednesday. We need to do it between shows so that people can come and get the maximum number of Broadway people. And we did.
We started texting.
Yeah.
I think I first texted Idina Menzel because I knew I had to have some names to make other people comfortable. Yeah. So I got Idina, I got Billy Porter, like maybe four people. And we got Broadway Records, who did our Disaster Cast album to sign on.
That's the other thing.
And they got us a studio for free. And you were there, right?
Yeah.
I remember
at the our matinee, Lynn turned to me and he was like, hey, are you going to Seth's thing? I was like, yeah, let's do it.
I love it. Seth's thing. And it wound up being great. So anyway, we did that. And then the election happened and we were both in London doing Disaster yet again. And we were devastated. And we thought, you know, what we always do, we got to put on a concert, mainly for our mental health because we knew we were going to be overwhelmed. But also to just, we knew so many groups were going to be screwed by this new government. And we said, we've got to help them. And as we were thinking about doing it, Jesse Mueller texted me and she said, what about doing a concert? We sing all patriotic songs. And she was listening to them. And she said, if anyone can do it, you guys can. And that kind of gave us the courage to do it. And then we kept hearing for weeks there were these other concerts happening.
Were these rumors. I don't know. Did you hear them? That there were there was this fake meme.
It was like Beyonce, Jay-Z.
Yeah, it's like huge, right?
And we're like, well, we can't compete with that.
Yeah, we're like, Broadway cannot compete. I'm sorry. Even Hamilton cannot compete with Jay-Z. And you know what I mean?
It's like, forget it. And then then we kind of heard it wasn't happening. And then it was the end of December. And I said, oh my God, the inauguration is a couple weeks away. I said, James, we can't like save the world. We have to stop like pushing it. And James called me December 30th. I was in Florida with Matt Morrison doing a show. And he said, I really thought about it. We have to do it. I was like, all right. And then we just got it done in a couple weeks.
Yeah.
And James said, it has to be every month. And he said, I really want to go across the country because everyone in the country needs to be cheered up. And that's what we started doing.
And a big component of it, and a big component of it is Facebook Live. So
yes, for, the Facebook Live
for
is
all
great.
Of your listeners, Rory, that's yeah. right, who aren't in San Francisco, who want to come, I mean, who can't come but would like to, they can watch it on right. Facebook.
Yeah,
yeah,
and we got like
that's amazing.
We got a ton of views for the last concert. It's really great. I got a letter from someone in North Dakota. Like, I mean, people are really watching it, which I think is so wonderful. I'm not really even cool enough to watch that on Facebook Live. I'm like, wait, what is that? Like, literally, the fact that you wanted to Skype me, I'm like, I don't even know if I have Skype. So like, it's way beyond me Facebook Live, but I know that other people enjoy it. FYI,
right.
I'm old.
Yes. No, it's a big deal, and it's giving people access to things that they didn't have access to before.
Yeah.
I think that Hamilton, one of the reasons that it's had this kind of success and this reach is because Lin-Manuel Miranda is so good at social media and so good at the, you know, cutting edge of like people. I would walk backstage at Hamilton or down into the green room area, and people would be like, hey, you were so funny on Snapchat. I don't have a Snapchat, but you're just constantly 100%. on television. You're constantly live.
Yeah.
That's when why you're at Hamilton. Slips, we're on Skype. By the way, speaking of Facebook Live, wonderful. I think we were the first Broadway show, Disaster, to Facebook Live, an actual live performance. We got Jennifer Simard's Nun song on Facebook. I don't even know how they got the rights. But they did it during the performance. Someone Facebook Live did it. It was totally like cleared through the unions.
Yeah, it was cleared. Yeah.
That's really?
Yeah, I wish they did it. I don't know why they haven't done it since.
They did that for Cynthia Erivo's final performance.
Was Facebook Live?
Of I'm Here, yeah.
Yeah, if I knew what Facebook Live was, I'd be super excited. Don't know what it is. Anywho.
So not true.
I sort of know, but I've never seen it. But anyway, so we're going to be at the Current in San
Francisco. Please,
it,
within like 3 months, Seth is going to have a Facebook Live show
right.
that is like number one on Facebook and Broadway.
How dare
Give
you.
Give me a break.
All right, so promote the shit. It's Saturday at the Current Theater, and it's you, and it's Alan Cumming, and it's Jane Lynch, and Faith Prince, and Kevin Chamberlain, and Hal Sparks, and Sharon Gless, which is Mother's Son from Queer as Folk. Hey.
Ugh.
And that's you're awesome. You're taking off Hamilton that night. You're under that night, correct? Because you're sick.
Right. Oh yeah, sure. No, I'm literally starting the show at 7 and then running to the theater to be in the show at 8.
Can I just give you a little fun side story to relate to you? I did the Funny Girl. Speaking of big concert, did the Funny Girl concert for the Actors Fund. I did one every year, and we were on a Monday as usual. And Sutton, we had a different Fanny Bryce for every song. And Sutton Foster was doing "I'm the Greatest Star." She just won the Tony Award. It was like perfect timing. And suddenly that Monday, AT&T bought out the house to see Thurman and Millie. So she suddenly had a show, and it couldn't be like they bought out the house. And at this performance, you know, the role of Joyce DeWitt.
Yeah, yeah.
So I said, we begin at 7:30. I said, we'll probably be maybe 10 minutes late, and you're within the first 10 minutes. So she literally came to the theater in full Thurman and Millie wig. She was fully wigged. She did "I'm the Greatest Star," and her fun exit as Fanny Bryce was literally up the aisle so she could run out of the Broadway theater and then get to her theater at the Marriott. So
that's
right back at you.
Brilliant. That's amazing.
Which is going to be
that's
you as
amazing.
Well.
No,
so
I will
not
be showing
be...
up on Saturday in a thoroughly modern Millie wig.
Oh, yeah. Well, King George, they're both fops. It's perfect.
That's true.
It's a
I
short
can do whatever
bob.
I want, really. I do wear a wig. No, it's going to be a great night. I'm so impressed and in awe of what you guys have done this year, what you've always done, but it really takes a lot of leadership and work to do something like this. And people don't realize how much work it does because I've done something on other scales with Broadway
and Polly
stuff. What that gave me was the understanding of how much work it takes to pull anything off. To do what you guys have done this year is astounding. And I'm so grateful that you have continued to be leaders in the Broadway community for doing what's right, using the power of the stage to make change. And, it's going to just keep getting bigger and bigger. And I think that you guys have come in at the right moment with the right, feeling and the right song, and it just everything about it makes me so thrilled. So thank you so
much.
I'm excited for Saturday. It's going to be fun.
See you on Saturday.
See you on Saturday.
Yes.
All right, James is peacing out. James, go take care of our child. And also, go let the dog eat.
James has to get back to work.
Oh, yeah. It's nonstop. It's 24 hours.
You guys have a lot. But I want to keep talking to you about your career and who you are, because I think that when I started this podcast, which is a podcast about It's called Living the Dream. It's about living your dream day to day.
Now, is it living with an apostrophe or living?
No apostrophe. Okay. No apostrophe, sure. Because I'm from Ohio, and that's just way, way too hip.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
So, yeah, it's Living the Dream. Mm-hmm. And it's been great to talk to a bunch of different people who had their start, you know, going to Carnegie Mellon for musical theater and doing the same hustle as being actors. What you've done, though, is so unique to anyone. I read an article where you said that you 100% have to create your own career. You have to, even if you win a Tony Award, you have to create the next step of what your career is and not just wait for someone to give you the right role or the next right step. So you went from being in the Broadway, you majored in piano at Oberlin.
Wow, yes.
Right? And you were in a pit of a Broadway show and playing in the pit as a musician, and now you are in charge of Broadway. So,
yeah.
So, but you know, the steps to get there, I think a lot of times people on the outside will think, wow, somebody must have saw something in Seth and started giving him this, that, and the other thing, book deals, having him be on Sirius XM, giving him the chance to be up in front of an audience, you know, from being in the pit. Yes, that's true, but you are the one who had to create what your career even is. It doesn't exist. You're the one who made it. So I think you're such an interesting person to talk to because I want to know how you did it. I want to know, the walls that you hit to get there and the ways that you were able to kind of overcome that and keep going, because I'm sure that there were tons of times where it was like, it's too much to create your own path. So let's start from the beginning a little bit. You were in Oberlin College being a piano player, but you always loved Broadway. And how did you wind up in New York? You grew up in Long Island.
And, you know, I always had, Broadway was always my first love, but I was a talented classical pianist. Right. I probably wanted to major in theater, but I kind of, it was in the 80s. It wasn't necessarily that normal to major in musical theater. It just wasn't really as it is now, or with like Michigan and it was kind of just starting, I feel. So anyway, I kind of got into college and I got into Oberlin early when I played my classical piano audition. I was like, oh my God, I guess I have to go. Like, I was so happy I got in. I guess
I have to go to the greatest music school in the country, I guess.
But I knew I wasn't going to be a concert pianist, but I thought it was so cool that I got in. And then when I visited, like, it was so liberal and I just thought it was amazing. So, yeah. I went, but as typical in my life, like, I've always had a multitude of interests, and I feel like people have tried to kind of pigeonhole me, and first of all, that's not the real world. Like, who only has one interest anyway? So it's just bizarre to me that people do get pigeonholed, because nobody has just one interest. So anyway, I was a classical piano major, but of course I was like doing musicals on the side, and in terms of, let's say, forming my own career, I really started that. Hold on, James. Can you give poor our little sweet dog wants a treat? Can you give her something?
We love dogs on the podcast.
Oh yeah. By the way, I'm obsessed.
They're always.
It's one of my biggest causes. Is animals. Yeah. All rescues. Just give her the thing that's in the closet. In terms of forming my own career, it really started at Oberlin, like, because I'd say sophomore year. It's like the way that the Dream Girls concert. I was like, I've always wanted to play Rhapsody in Blue, and you have winter projects in Oberlin. So I was like, I'll play Rhapsody in Blue. I'll literally get a symphony orchestra together. Everyone here is an amazing classical musician. I put a little sign-up sheet on the board, and my winter term project was doing Rhapsody in Blue, and I got this big, crazy orchestra together, and I played it. And it was amazing. So it was the kind of when I really began to realize, like, oh my God, I could just kind of like do whatever I want if I just ask people. Everyone wants to have fun. So I did that there, and I love Broadway music, so I applied to be the Broadway radio host, and I started doing that for funsies. Anyway, I studied classical music, but I did a lot of musical theater, and then one of my friends at Oberlin worked at Summerstock, and he said, oh, do you want to be my musical assistant, director assistant? So that was my first professional job, music directing, and it was so cool to actually do a show and know there was an audience coming that was like actually paying. I remember going, I can't believe everyone in this audience is paying money. Like, it was so exciting. And it was Summerstock, which is an amazing training, because it was 1 week stock, as it's called. So as you do one show during the day, you're doing another one at night. And it was 12 weeks. So it was like promises, applause, grease. I mean, every single week. So whatever show I didn't know, I learned. And also I really learned how to be a good music director there, because you have basically one rehearsal, like, for each song. So you have to dilute exactly how you're going to teach this because you don't have 3 hours. So it's like, what is the clearest way to get this across? And I think that's always been a big skill of mine, is how to teach music very clearly. I've always really enjoyed it, and I definitely honed it in summer stock. And I graduated, and, you know, I guess if you want an overview of what you should do is basically do as many things as you can, because every single person you meet will lead to something. So, you know, when I got to New York, I already knew people from summer stock, and I began playing their auditions, and, you know, it eventually getting to Broadway's, I was interning at this theater, and I met this woman, Maria Bossi, who I thought was really funny, and she said, oh, you should do a cabaret act with me. And as we were writing it together, I began to kind of improv lines, and suddenly we both had roles. So we were both doing basically this comedy show together. And one week I couldn't make it, and this other pianist did it for me, and then he got a Broadway show, and I said, can I be your sub? And that's how I kind of made it to Broadway. It's just all like through knowing people. I mean, that's really how – it's not like being an actor where you go and you audition and you're good. When you're a musician, especially, it's from knowing people, and that's also been my career. And it's not like having connections. It's like doing a good job and having someone else be impressed, and therefore they recommend you, or, you know, they trust you to do something.
Right. Yeah. You kind of – you prove yourself to that first person.
Yeah.
And then they're like, okay, I can trust this guy to come back again. And
exactly.
Yeah. That's – it's funny. A lot of times I think people don't want to take smaller things.
Right.
At the beginning, because they're like, I'm so good,
or right,
you know, like, I know what, how much I'm capable of, so I don't want to do this like small thing. But the truth is that you do that small thing and you're going to meet somebody who's going to get you start climbing some ladder. It's not a ladder that goes straight up, but it's that first rung, you know, of a lot of people shy away from.
That's how I got to television. I mean, like, you know, if you want one of those stories, is like the basis of this story, I guess, is don't ever take a job for money. Like, the one thing about me is, like, I've never, ever cared about money. You know, I don't want to be poor, but it's like, it's probably why I'm terrible with money and I don't own a house, but, like, it just doesn't matter to me. So anyway, my point is I've been playing a lot of Broadway shows, and I was doing comedy on the side, just to kind of everything I want to do. And the Easter Bonnet came along, which, for you people that don't know it, it's a big kind of variety show Broadway puts on every year for charity, Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS. So I was working on Grease, and I said, oh, I want to write the comedy sketch. And we wrote this comedy sketch because Brooke Shields had just taken over in Grease. So it was about, like, who do we get to find as a replacement for Rizzo? And, you know, we had a fake Maureen McCormick. And it was, you know, you're the one that I want, about Brooke Shields. So anyway, it went over really, really well. And finally, Barbara Kerr said, can you write the opening number for the Easter Bonnet?
Right.
And you know, it was a really big deal to me because it's, like, seen by all of Broadway. But the exact same time I was offered Forever Plaid in Hawaii, and I'd always wanted to go to Hawaii, and it was really good money, and I wasn't making really any money in those days, so I was like, do I get this vacation where I'm going to get paid a lot, or do I do this opening number for no money? But it was a combination of, I really believe in the charity, and also, like, I really enjoy being challenged, and I did not know if I could write an opening production number. It was not something I'd ever done before, so I said, I really want to do something like this, because it just seems so different from anything I've ever done. So I turned down Forever Plaid. And I wrote this opening number with up-and-coming choreographer, Kathleen Marshall. She'd never really done anything at that point. And we did it, you know, she choreographed it. And the point of my story is that in the audience was Rosie O'Donnell. And Rosie had known me from Grease because she was Rizzo. And we did a closing comedy show that I wrote for her. So she kind of knew that I was funny. But the point is, when she got her TV show, she called me and she said, can you write production numbers like Easter Bonnet for my TV show? And that's how I got a job writing on a TV show.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's one of those things, like, you just keep doing things. And I didn't take it for money. I didn't take Easter Bonnet for money, but it led to something. So back to your theory, just take everything, because it always leads to something.
Right. So take the things that, like, inspire you and make you excited.
Yes.
And even if that means not getting to go to Hawaii.
Yeah. And just on a side note, you know, one of my main jobs is interviewing people. And Sutton Foster was offered Eponine in Les Mis, or being in the chorus at Thoroughly Modern Millie. And it was more money than she'd ever made to play Eponine. And she turned it down because she told her agent, she said, I've already played Eponine in the national tour, and it's cool to be on Broadway, it's cool to make money. She goes, but I think Millie would be so fun. I believe in the show, and I don't care if I'm in the chorus. And then, of course, it led to her taking over the lead role and winning the Tony Award. But she literally took chorus.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so it's just...
That's insane.
You got to do what you think is fun and not... I'm not into those whole five-year plans. It's just, like, keep doing fun things and it keeps leading to something else that's fun.
Yeah, and you do have to take the chances. I mean, like, people on this podcast have heard the story many times, but me taking that Nerds show last year, And, you know, I knew that, hey, this is the season of Hamilton. This show isn't going to have a lot of room to last for a whole year. But I knew, like, this is going to be fun. It's going to be a good challenge. It's going to show something that I haven't gotten to do before. And it turns out I only got to do it in the rehearsal room for a casting director and our team. But that casting director turned out to be the casting director for Hamilton. And it's why I'm the king, because of that one day.
I love that. And by the way, you're taking the chorus in Book of Mormon. You didn't know it was going to turn into a role that's going to get you a Tony nomination.
Absolutely. I mean, that was an easy decision because I was working at BlackRock Financial in the human resources department.
Okay.
So that wasn't like, you know, which one should I do? But
you didn't take it to get a Tony nomination. You just took it because you're like, it's, you know, it's a gig.
Oh my God. I didn't even know what it was.
Yeah.
I just knew who was writing it. And I said, I'll be there. I'll be an assistant to just to be in that room.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, you never know what something is going to turn into. And you can, as I always say, you can only connect the dots back. You can't connect them forward.
That's so true. It's 100% true. But as long as you're enjoying it, then just do it. You know, and what's also fun about my radio show, what's so funny is that I did it in college and I used to cassette tape myself. And my mom for years would always, I had these cassette tapes of me DJing. She'd always say, you should host your own Broadway radio show. And I was like, I don't even know what that means. I said, what Broadway radio show? It's like, it doesn't exist. Like, I did it in college. What show are you saying I should do? Like, it's like saying, like, you really should, like, you know, ride around the rings of Saturn. I'm like, there is no Broadway radio show for me to host. And it just really, there was a Broadway radio show and I started hosting it.
Yeah.
So it's just weird. Like, I didn't even know that was going to happen, but I had the experience from college and that's what paid off for me getting SiriusXM.
But, well, how did that happen? I mean, working on the Rosie O'Donnell show and then you becoming a personality of a Broadway personality based on your deconstructing performances, doing the Broadway Cares events and putting on shows.
My big concerts.
And that was before SiriusXM, right?
No, deconstructing was after SiriusXM. SiriusXM came from the Rosie O'Donnell show. I was working as a comedy writer on that show for years. And the Grammy Awards happened and Rosie hosted it. And I've been doing stand-up comedy and sketch comedy, but I basically stopped when I became a writer on the show. And it was very behind the scenes, like I wore glasses. Anyway, so Rosie did the Grammy Awards and she took the red eye back. So she didn't want to rehearse the next morning because she was exhausted. So she had a number with Martin Short and they said, can you just be Rosie in this number? Because I used to write a lot of the comedy, the musical parodies. They said, can you just rehearse? You know Rosie's part, just do it. So I did it with Marty Short. And we had a live feed you'd be able to watch. And the writers saw it and they said, oh, you're such a good performer. Why don't, you know, not to brag, but they said, why don't you perform more? And I was like, oh, I don't perform anymore. And then I was like, wait, why don't I perform anymore? So I was like, why have I given this up? So I called my friend Richie Jackson, who I went to camp with, but who's like he is the executive producer of like Nurse Jackie.
Yeah.
He's a big one now. And I said, I want to start performing again, but you know, there's so many like Jewish-y actors. I'm like, how am I going to compete with that? I said, I really feel like what I do best is I have a really specific personality. And I said, well, why don't you start doing a talk show every week and then we could bring people from TV to see it and then you can get it on TV. So I started doing the thing called the Chatterbox. That's Broadway Chatterbox, which yet again, it seems so easy now looking back on it. I'm like, oh my God, of course I could do that. But I really didn't. I was like, I'm going to talk to someone for an hour about what? Like it really seemed crazy to me.
Yeah.
And right before that had happened, I talked to some other people on stage during a benefit, a quick little interview that I would always do for funsies. And David Friedman, who wrote Help Was on the Way, and he conducted all the Disney movies, he said, you're such an insider, but such a fan. And it kind of gave me confidence. I'm like, oh, that is what I am, kind of like Rosie. You know, that's sort of the same thing. So anyway, I started doing this Chatterbox every week, and P.S., it never got on TV. But I loved doing it because probably people would go on TV, they would get these four-minute interviews with no information, and they get them confused from pre-interviews because I remember Faith Prince during interviews when she was waiting for the Tony nomination for Guys and Dolls. She would always say, when I'm nervous, I cook and I was making pancakes and I got the call, I got nominated. I remember she was on Jay Leno and Jay Leno was like, Faith, where were you when you won the Tony Award? And she was like, I was making pancakes. It was like a crazy, and I was like, oh my God, does he not even understand? Or they interviewed Jane Krakowski for my concert. They're like, Jane Krakowski, you're doing Funny Girl, but this time it's a musical. And I was like, oh my God, no one understands anything. So I was like, I want to do Chatterbox where I actually understand Broadway and I could really ask great questions because I love Broadway. So anyway, began doing the Chatterbox. And then Richie came to see me and my best friend, Jack Plotnick. We both wound up writing a disaster together. But in those days, we were a comedy team. Plotnick and Rudetsky, colon, we have awful last names. Well, that's what we wanted to call ourselves. We never gave the colon, but we always wanted to call ourselves that. But anyway, we're doing this comedy show, and it's very signature our comedy, where I like play tapes of myself when I was a kid and show how fat I was. Just like a lot of comedy about what losers we were. Anyway, Richie came to see it and he said, I know you guys think it's the comedy, but I kind of see it as about two outcasts that took what made them outcasts and then made careers out of them. And Jack was like, I don't identify with that. And I was like, I do. So I wrote this one-person show called Rhapsody and Seth. So I played it off Broadway. I got an agent from it. And I was doing a round of interviews. And I was interviewed on Sirius XM. And I'd never even heard of it. And I went over this interview. And P.S., it was a horrific interview where literally the interviewer said to me at the beginning, I saw your show last night. Listen, I just flew – by the way, microphone's on. I just flew in from L.A., so I apologize that I fell asleep during it. I was like, Oh my God. You're saying this. Like, it was so passive aggressive. Anyway.
Oh my God.
And I was in a bad, I was like, you're an idiot and I'm tired. Regardless, the head of the Broadway channel, Mike Peters, came up to me and he said, I just heard your interview. You're really good on the radio. And I was like, I am. I was like, I was so angry. And he said, no, you're really good. He said, do you have any like recordings of yourself?
He's like, you didn't fall asleep like the guy we have on now. So that's pretty
seriously,
good.
Seriously, you have, you were able to stay awake for a full 20 minutes. So he said, do you have any, you know, any audio on you doing interview, whatever. And I said, oh, I said, well, I did a BB Newirth interview and I recorded it. So I just gave it to him. I said, this is like me, you know, talking Broadway. So I gave him the BB Newirth interview. And then a couple weeks later, he said, you know, do you want to start DJing here on Saturday and Sunday nights? Which I thought was a big deal. Now I know it's like the graveyard shift. Like nobody listens to Saturday and Sunday nights, but I was like, all right. So I did it. And literally a week later, he was like, oh my God, you're amazing. I mean, not to brag, but he's like, you're amazing. We want you on 7 days a week. And literally, by the way, even then I was like, I don't know, whatever. I just started doing it. I didn't know what it was going to be. And what it turned out to be was it changed my whole career because I can go do shows in other cities and people know who I am. Like, how the hell would anyone know who the hell I am? Like, Seattle, San Francisco. But
it's just, everyone from Broadway knows that when you leave New York, one of the first things that people say to you is, I've listened to you on Sirius XM.
That's so great.
You know,
people
Seth,
listen.
And people will say to me, Seth knows who you are. I'm like, yes. And he's like, he talked about you on his show. I'm like, oh, well, good. I'm glad that you think that I'm someone now.
That's hilarious.
Or, you know, Christine Petty or Julie James, that people who are personalities on Sirius XM Broadway around the country, because Broadway is not in something that's, you know, they can go to like we can.
Right.
That is their main way to hear it, to be a part of it. And certainly if it was around when I was growing up, I would have been devouring it like I was the Rosie O'Donnell show, which was my main outlet for Broadway.
That was around when you were growing up? Great. I was 70 when it started.
Well, welcome to my world. I'm in Hamilton. I'm the oldest man in the show. And
where's the fun part?
It's fine.
You know, I really
I sang the Facts of Life theme song.
Yes.
And they had no idea what I was singing. I was like, I need to get around older gay people immediately.
A, holy shite. B,
I know.
Concert for America is coming to Atlanta and Kim Fields is going to be in it.
Get out.
So Tootie, back at ya.
Tootie.
Thank you.
I love you. So you're on 7 days a week.
Well,
Sirius XM Broadway.
Well, yeah, I guess I am on seven. Well, basically six.
But
or seven.
but initially, yes. Like they take you from the graveyard shift to basically being the face of Sirius XM.
One of the faces.
Broadway. Yes. But so that changes things for you because you can go around the country, you can do your show much more.
Yeah.
But then you start getting into things like writing books and
You know, that actually maybe even been a little bit before. Basically, that was I went to the Barnes & Noble. I love reading. I can't tell you how much I love books. I went to Barnes & Noble and I saw, like, The Nanny Diaries, like, the inside scoop on being a nanny. And I was like, what about the inside scoop on Broadway? I was like, why has no one written that? So I wrote this book called Broadway Nights, which Cheyenne Jackson thought was my diary. And I'm like, really? The lead character is having an affair. Like, you really think I would write about an affair? Anyway, it's purely fiction book. But I'm so angry at him. But anyway, I wrote Broadway Nights. And then my agent said, you know, a really big market is young adult books, especially with lead gay characters. He said, if you write a young adult book with a lead gay character, because I know a big publishing house will publish it. So I wrote it, and I got a book deal with Random House. And on my audiobook, I think a certain Rory J. O'Malley was featured. It was you and I'm trying to think which one you were on. Were you with the one with Jesse Tyler Ferguson?
Yes.
Yes. It was you, Jezebel Ferguson, and Megan Hilty. And I wrote that. Yeah. That was my awesome, awful popularity plan. And then I wrote the sequel, which is The Rise and Fall of a Theater Geek. And I just always love to write. So, yeah, I write books on the side because I enjoy it. I do. I like to write.
I write books on the side because I enjoy it.
Well, please.
That's wonderful.
I'm not guaranteeing they're all going to get published, but, you know, I've been lucky. But that's been, talk about a struggle. That was a major struggle. I mean, I haven't even talked about that for a second. Just going back with the whole thing about struggling. It's like my Dreamgirls concert. I did a big fundraiser for the Gay and Lesbian Synagogue. Lilias White sang Effie. And I was like, oh my God, I can't believe how good she is. I want to do this on Broadway with Lilias with an orchestra. And I was like, I know it would make money. And I was like, it's never going to be revived this minute. So why don't I just put in a one night concert of it? And I went to like major charities and they were like, we don't want to use a full orchestra. What about a rock band? I was like, no, I was like, it has to be full orchestra. So believe me, I could have just been like, oh, well, I guess not. But I finally went to the Actors Fund and they were like, yes. So the Actors Fund did it, but I totally got a lot of no's. My first book, I can't even tell you the amount of rejection letters I got. Like, it was relentless. And in a sense, it makes you, I remember even my agent, not doubted me, but he was like, you know, he was like, maybe put it away and then revisit it. And I started reading it again and I was like, no, I was like, I think it's a really good book. Like, I'm not afraid to get criticism, but I'm really not. But I was reading it and I was like, I enjoy it. And that's kind of my main, MO, is that the word, modus operandi, for anything I've ever done. It's like, well, I enjoy this in the audience. So I always go by my taste. That's the easiest way for me to create. So I was really enjoying my book, you know, and I really liked it. Anyway, I finally got a publishing deal, but that was, I literally went at one point, my agent said, worst comes to worst, go to, and it was some horrific publishing house. He goes, worst comes to worst, go to this publishing house. I can't present it to them because they pay no money, but you can. And I sent it to them and they rejected it. It was literally the worst comes to worst. Literally, they don't even pay. They're like,
worst came to worst.
Yeah, and it actually got worse. So like, I've completely faced, and even on the radio, I still get like hate mail. Like, why do you talk at all? We want music. And then I have to be like, I don't know, I'm paid to do that. Like, I don't know what to say.
Well, if people are listening to Sirius XM Broadway, you know, they could just have a playlist.
Right.
You know, like you are trying to engage in the community. But, you know, everyone has a lot of opinions, especially in our community.
Yeah.
But I think that it goes to say that you are authentic to who you are and you always have been, and that there aren't people who in the places who make decisions who always understand who your audience is, and you have had to kind of make a path and cultivate that audience and show the people who make decisions, like, this is a group of people who want this content, who want this message, who want access in this way.
Well, you know, it's interesting when you say about the audience, because to this day, I either get this, I listen to your radio show and I'm straight. And I go, what does that literally have to do with anything? I go, guess what? Broadway is an American art form. Broadway's been loved by America for years. America is actually, the minority of people in America is gay. So obviously the majority of America liked Broadway to keep it alive. Ed Sullivan was straight. He was a crazy right-wing person. So this stupid theory that Broadway is gay infuriates me, because it's basically why the arts have been cut. Because it's like, why do we need to have the arts in high school? It's for gay people. It's not for gay people. And I literally will continually, I mean, I remember there was one great article about Sirius XM. This guy was like, I know nothing about Broadway, but I love listening to Seth Rudetsky's show because it just kept me engaged for whatever reason. Like, and that's what I have a passion about Broadway, and that's what I think engages people. But this theory that only gay people listen to my show is so moronic and infuriating to me.
Is that something that you get presented with a lot? Or?
Oh, well, I get it mostly from fans. I get like, my father listens and he's a straight Navy person. I go, uh-huh. I guess he enjoys the arts as most humans do. So yeah, no, I get it all the time. Or even people saying, someone just today interviewed me and said, oh, I'm a big show queen. And I was like, why are you a queen? Because you like Broadway. What you're implying is I'm feminine and basically weak because I like this art form. And I'm like, no, you're actually a theater fan. I don't understand why you have to demean yourself because you like Broadway. It just drives me up the wall.
Yeah. No, I get that. And certainly I think we lived through a childhood probably that, you know, kind of like equated the two, when in fact, it's not that you loving Broadway or loving theater makes you gay. I'll actually 100% tell you that it's not what makes me gay.
Yes.
But the fact that the community of theater is an oasis, a safe haven
yes.
for a lot of gay people where they are accepted. That could be in sports too. It's just not done. And it's that's unfortunate.
Right. You're not accepted in sports if you're gay, but certainly gay people like sports and certainly straight yes. people like Broadway. And it's gotten more marginalized, much more marginalized over the last 20 years than it used to be. Broadway used to be for everybody. And now it's much right. more thought of as a gay thing. And it drives me crazy.
Well, I think that like, not to keep bringing it back to Hamilton,
no, but
I
should.
Do think that.
No, because that
somehow
has.
I bring up Hamilton every 20 minutes.
Not to keep bringing up musical.
Half an hour.
No, but it's true. Hamilton but, really but, has made it more mainstream. You're
yeah,
right.
It has. I mean, I just had dinner with my cousins who live in a suburb of San Jose yesterday. There's three girls and the oldest is 13 years old. And she said that she loves Hamilton. And there's a group of people who like don't like Hamilton and they debate about it all the time in eighth grade. And she was like, I'm sorry they don't like it. I was like, are you kidding me? The fact that there are eighth graders who even know what Hamilton is.
Yeah.
I was like, no one would have a discussion with me about Sweeney Todd in
right.
eighth grade.
Exactly.
I would have killed to have the debate.
Right. Dorothy
that would have been amazing.
Angela Lansbury, get back to me.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, I think that as we started talking about, like with Facebook Live and social media and Sirius XM and ways that people have had access to
and NBC
the
Live,
content
all
of
those
Broadway.
Live musicals.
I 100% agree. Let's talk about that for a second. I've talked about this on the podcast. Those musicals, people give such a hard time in our community about them and they have mm-hmm. from the beginning. And I understand that, you know, like I want them always to be amazing. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's a huge deal, a game changer that networks are fighting for which musicals to be put on television live.
Yeah, two things I'll say about it. A, whenever they're like, why are they casting so-and-so? I'm so bored with that. It's like, unfortunately, we're always going to have to cast some level of stars because the regular world doesn't care that much about Broadway. So you've got to sucker them in with somebody. So stop complaining that right. so-and-so is cast. Second of all, the shows are figuring out how to do it. The whole not having any audience, they kind of finally realized was too weird that you'd end a number to total crickets. So now they're adding yes. an audience. It's sort of like watching Seinfeld and being like, this show is bad. It's like, right, it's the first two episodes. It's going to get better. So it's like these live
right.
musicals will keep getting better when they start realizing it. But stop being so mean about them. Shut up.
I know. That's exactly how I felt. Like, I literally want to meet Carrie Underwood and hug her just for the fact
yeah,
that she started this and people want to like give her shit for belting
job.
Maria. She did a great job and she belted Maria
yeah.
and we'll never get to have that again. So just enjoy it for the one
and by
time
the way,
that
Mary
it
Martin
happened.
Belted it. Like those are the original keys.
Yeah, okay.
So shove it.
Yeah. Yes. And she literally started, launched, an art form, a new medium.
A new medium.
Of the way that we love, to have storytelling be told through music and it's awesome. And it's getting better. Each one gets better and better.
I
when they
agree.
Figure it out.
My God, Jesus Christ Superstar is going to be amazing.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. So let's talk a little bit more about the state of the actual Broadway stage right now. Our buddy Gavin Creel won a Tony Award.
Oh my God. Roy, that meal we had in Provincetown, to this day, I can't stop laughing how funny you were. Remember when he ordered pasta and it was like, is it rotini or is it pappardella? And like it is rotini. And you were like, what does it make a difference? You're like, I will not have that shape in my mouth. Anyway, it was such a good analysis.
Because people make such a big deal about the shape of the pasta. I'm like, it's still just put it in.
That's
for
so
God's sake.
Funny. Anyway, yeah, Gavin, James, and I, we were actually at the 20 Awards this year. We leapt to our feet. I was crying. I was so happy for him.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, obviously, we both know Gav and love him, but it's about the work that he's put in.
Oh my
to that
God.
Moment.
He should have. I mean, my one disappointment, I said in the radio show today, I really want him to win for originating a role instead of doing a revival. He's such a unique performer. Like, shows should be written on his voice. So I just want that to be the next step for him, that he originates something.
Yeah. Well, and he should. And hopefully something will be built around him.
Oh,
and,
my God.
And that voice and
the dancing, the acting, like everything.
Dancing. Everything. Now, I haven't seen Hello, Dolly.
He's amazing.
Which has been very difficult for me. This is like the first Broadway season that I haven't been there for. So it's rough. But what do you think of the current state of Broadway just in general? Like the shows that are out now, things that are happening. What are your thoughts?
I'm very happy that I feel there's good original stuff out there that be quiet, my dog keeps barking. That, you know, there's always been this theory that, oh, if we make this famous movie into a musical, it's going to sell tickets. I feel like people are realizing that that's no longer a surefire way to do something. And sometimes it is amazing. I mean, although Hairspray wasn't really a big hit, it was more of a cult hit. But the point is, it can definitely work. But what I love is that shows that are just written to be creative are, I mean, like Hamilton. I mean, talk about a boring-ass subject matter. So I love that that's happening, that there's creativity and people are taking chances on stuff. And a lot of times you say taking chances on stuff, it means a horrible atonal score. I'm not saying take a chance on something, a splitting headache, but I'm saying take a chance on something that's not based on something that you think from your marketing research will do well. So that I appreciate. I mean, my biggest thing that I talk about all the time, and I it's a losing battle, is the state of the orchestra. It's really devastating to me. You listen to these old shows and you just hear that amazing string section and everyone says, oh, you don't need it anymore because you can use synthesizers and microphones. And it doesn't sound the same. And it's literally devastating to me that it doesn't sound the same way as it used to sound. And I talk about it all the time on the radio. And there also is a use of lip syncing on Broadway, which is so horrific to me. And it is so noticeable to me whenever you see these big dance numbers and there's this total even sound, this wall of sound coming towards you, instead of the unevenness of someone dancing, which makes it exciting because it's live. You hear unevenness. You hear this wall of sound. I can't stand it because it's like being in a theme park. And it's definitely
so weird. I haven't noticed it. I mean, you have clearly a much better ear, but I haven't noticed
the mega
that
mix of Mamma Mia. It's this wall of sound, a wall of there's no liveness to it. Like, you know, people huffing and puffing, like there's a liveness to that. And instead it's just a perfect sound. Oh, it makes me crazy.
Right. Like you might as well just stay home and listen to the recording.
Listen to the Cast album or go to a theme park. You know, and then people use this theory like, you can't sing and you can't dance at that level and sing. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, every Broadway show has had crazy singing. Now look, A Chorus Line had a lot of dancing and they had background singers, those people that are cut from the opening number, went backstage and sang to microphones. But it was an additional 6 people. They didn't have 30 people singing it and the cast on stage lip sync. The cast on stage sang and then they had an additional 6 singers. It's a complete myth. It's the same myth that producers use when they go, oh, an orchestra is too expensive. An orchestra is not too expensive. Custom-made shoes are too expensive, or a crazy-ass set that no one gives a shit about is too expensive. But this myth that a full orchestra is expensive is a complete and, I mean, unadulterated lie, and it infuriates me. Love, Seth.
Well, thank you, Seth.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. You know, you always hold back on your opinion, and so I'm glad that you could give me straight up today. Yes, finally, Seth speaks.
Yes, thank you. A dare you name drop.
Like I said, I wanted to talk to you on the podcast because I'm so amazed at all of the different twists and turns that your career has taken and will continue to take.
Thank you.
And the fact that you and James have done all of this work for charity, for a good cause, on top of everything that you're doing, and you have a family together.
Ooh.
You know, like, forget that. That's kind of like what I think is most important to talk about in this podcast, because people don't really get to talk about that when they go on interviews and talk about Broadway. How have you been able to maintain family life, family structure in all of the craziness that is your life, which is, you're the first person who is so busy that has suggested that we do 20 minutes and then take a break so you could do whatever you had to do and then do another 20 minutes later.
It was easy for me that way. you know, I've been really lucky. I go out of town a lot, but because I do a lot of shows around the country, but I'm notorious, and people I work with, they think I'm crazy, but I'll always take a 6 a.m. flight back because I want to get back and live my New York life. So I'll always basically get to the venue the day of and I'll leave the next morning at 6 o'clock. So yes, I travel a lot, but I think it's really important to be back with my family. So I do these very quick trips. And I've been really lucky that a multitude of my trips, I could bring my family on. So it's like basically every single cruise, I'm doing Seth's Big Fat Broadway Cruise. We leave from Seattle, go to Alaska, and I'm bringing the whole family. So a lot of stuff I'm quote-unquote busy with, but the family's always there. I mean, Disaster, James and I did together, and Julie was backstage. You know, we kind of do things together all the time. That's, I guess, how you maintain it. The only way to not maintain it is to be separate too much, and I don't think we are.
Right. No, I mean, you definitely have found a way. And obviously, when you are making a life with somebody, you have the same interests, and luckily you and James have the same passion, and that really helps.
Yeah, I love working with him. I think of us as Lucy and Desi, you know, like without the alcoholism and cheating. But like, really, like, I mean, you know, they couldn't help it. That was like way before therapy. I think they really did love each other. I'm obsessed with Lucy and Desi.
I totally agree.
But they were so creative. And that's how I kind of think of me and James, that we do all these creative ventures together. I love doing it. I really trust his opinion.
Well, and so let's end with talking about Disaster, which was a huge creative process and was an amazing show.
Thank you.
You wrote it. You starred in it.
I had to.
I mean, you did so much work. And I'm sure that was not just like a easy street path.
No, even it's so funny because we're going to London now. I mean, well, we're planning on it. We're still signing contracts and whatnot.
Right.
But I was really impressed. It's funny. I was emailing with the producer of Natasha Pierre. And I said, oh, my God, the Tony Awards, you had like the rising, everything. And he wrote, he said, oh, I've always said bigger is better for this show. And I said, God, I felt that way about Disaster. You know, because Natasha Pierre began at Ars Nova, which is like, you know, a stage.
Yeah.
That's where I did Rhapsody and Seth, my one-person show. Like, that's how big the stage is. And I think people have this myth in their head, like if it begins in a small space, it's a small show. And when I was doing Disaster, people kept being like, how is it going to transfer to Broadway? It's really small. And I was like, no, we took a Broadway-sized show and we shoved it into a little theater, but it's about earthquakes and tidal waves and disco. Where is the small part? Like, literally, they acted like it was a one-person show about physics that I had a little – I'm like, it's literally an earthquake and tidal wave, killer bees, and disco music. I don't understand what the small – but anyway, it was a constant struggle to explain to people. It's not a little comedy sketch. It's literally a show. So that was hard. Also, people kept saying to me, you're never going to get the song rights. You're never going to get the song rights. And some of this famous producer was like, you're never going to get the song. And finally, I was like – I think it was – by the way, just FYI, going back for a second – we first did it as a benefit for Only Make Believe, this great charity that brings theater to hospitalized children. And I said to James, I said, oh, I really wanted to get it to Off-Broadway, but, you know, no one's contacting me to produce it. And we were at Aroma Coffee on 72nd Street, and James said, why don't you do it at, what's it called? Not Steve McGraw's, the Triad. And I was like, that's where I did Forever Plaid. It's literally and Forbidden Broadway. It's for four people on stage. And he said, it doesn't matter. Just do it there. So it was James' idea. So we shoved this big show into this little space. But because we did that, we got this great New York Times review. So my point is, like, I guess, A, James has always been the engine behind Disaster. That's what I love. Yeah. He was one propelling it. But in terms of the struggle, everyone kept saying, you're never going to get the song rights. And finally, James said, well, why don't you just try to get the song rights yourself? So my friend had written Rock of Ages. And I said, who got your song rights? And he said, this woman, Janet Billy Gridge. So I wrote a very nice email and she wrote me back, which is why I'm so lucky. Oh my God, I'm a big fan of yours from SiriusXM. And I'm like, oh my God, that radio show is like the gift that you're giving. Like, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And she got the song rights. And I just, the one I think very inspiring story I'll tell is that it was difficult to get the song rights. And when we got to Broadway, the song rights changed. And Jennifer Samard had been this major hit off Broadway. She played Numb with the Gambling Addiction. And she sang Signs Brilliant. Delivered. And she got a Drama Desk nomination and all the reviews. And literally a month before we began rehearsals, I had to call her and say, we don't have the rights for Signs Still Delivered. And it was literally the song that like made her a star off Broadway. And the good news is James had been researching for weeks another song. And I kept saying, why are you researching? We're going to get the rights. And he was like, what about it? I was like, stop bothering me. But he kept researching it. And then I said, well, why don't you do Heaven Knows? Heaven Knows. She's a nun. And it's not the way it should be. You know, she's gambling. And I was sort of committing to it, and I was really happy about it. And James was like, he kept looking. I was like, stop looking. I already chose a song. Anyway, he said, what about Never Can Say Goodbye? And I was like, oh, my God, it's so good because Sunset was delivered. She gives herself over to the slot machine. But Never Can Say Goodbye is a struggle of I love you, but I hate you, but I love
never
you.
Can say goodbye.
And I called Jennifer, and I said, we lost the rights, but we got a new song. So it was on Thanksgiving. She was chopping vegetables. She was devastated. And then she called me back. She goes, okay, I processed it. And she goes, let's actually make it even better. And it was a great way to look at it. It's like, we had a great
song.
That's
amazing.
Yeah. And she got a Tony nomination. So
it helps when you're a comedic genius. Like she just has that.
So
you could give her the phone book. She would be funny.
She is brilliant. But I guess my point is for those of you that think, oh my God, this star quit the show or we lost this venue or you with nerds, it's like, you don't you may think something is terrible, but if you just kind of keep hoping and working on something, it could get even better. And that's what happened with Disaster. We were devastated, and it actually worked out even better for her.
That's amazing. I think that, you know, one of the themes from your story and what I think is so important is that a lot of times people are ready to go to auditions and hear no, but they aren't ready to like get in the actual world of this business and hear no and think like that's normal. It's normal. You hear no every day, all the
time.
You
have to not, that's a thing. It's like the serenity prayer, you know, God grant me the serenity to change things I can't. You have to know who to believe and who not to believe. And that is a real trick, because people say no, and you're like those publishers for my book, like, it's not a good book. I'm like, I could either have been like, I guess it's not, or I could be like, what is their advice? Let me try to take it. Or I could go, I actually don't believe you. And I remember being at the gym with my trainer, and I was saying, oh, this producer rejected Disaster. And he was like, why don't you produce it? This is when we first went to Broadway. And I was like, oh, I'm not a producer. Then I was like, wait, what is a producer? I was like, it's just called a person. I was like, they don't have a degree in producing. They're literally just people. I was like, why don't I produce it? And that's why we produce it off Broadway. So the point is, you do hear no, and you have to know what to trust within that no. It's like, you know, what do you change to make it a yes? And I was really inspired by Tina Fey's book. She says over, under, through. It's like someone is blocking you. Instead of pushing against them, Sesame Street style, go over, under, through to get what your goal is. And that's really inspired me.
Yeah. Now, I think that you embody that. And I'm so impressed with what you've created and your career. I am. I've always expressed this to you, because there's just no one who's done what you've done.
You're also one of the nice people in the business. So I it's hard to take a compliment and not go, oh, he's just being polite. But I do appreciate
I am serious. I mean, I'm not just having you on this podcast to have other people hear how you did this. I wanted to know.
Oh, you're sweet,
because
Rory.
I think that you do have to make your own career. And if you're going to keep finding the things that inspire you, that keep you authentic in the way that you have, that you have to figure out how other people have done it. And, you know, that's kind of the reasons that I'm doing this podcast. So I really appreciate you giving me the time in your very busy day, which is every day of your life.
But it's all fun busyness. I'm not in the coal mine. I'm having fun.
No, of course. You do it with joy, and that's why you can keep doing it, you know? But I'm really excited for Saturday. I hope that everybody in San Francisco comes to see the big show Saturday night.
Thank you.
And I will see you there.
You look super handsome on Skype, FYI.
Oh, thank you. You know, I might have chosen this lighting.
The lighting's amazing.
Good for me. I mean, I don't want my guests to be sick to their stomach in the wrong
light. No, if anything, I'm incredibly jealous of the old husband. So, Mr. O'Malley, he still got it. Just saying.
All right.
Work. All right, will see you Saturday in San Francisco.
Thank you for doing this.
All right, bye, Rory.
Audition, side job, swimming upstream. Believe it or not, you're living the dream.
Have you ever wondered how your favorite performer actually feels? Well, here's your chance. Welcome to The Quiet Part Out Loud with me, Bobby Steggert, Broadway actor, and now a therapist to a whole host of Broadway creatives. Part interview, part therapy, this is not your typical podcast. We'll go right to the heart of things with some of your favorite artists, what they still struggle with, what lessons they've learned, what they haven't figured out yet. There's enormous power in saying the quiet part out loud. Are you listening?
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.